How many of you look at that title and already feel defeated? Have no memory left? This is a passage which is in our daily Bible reading, was in our daily Bible reading yesterday, and I noticed it a couple weeks ago, and I wanted to think through it with all of us because of the way in which this one thing defines what we are trying to do together here today. I think the best one-word summary of what's expected to happen when the whole church gathers together on the Lord's Day, the one word is remember. You notice how often we read from 1 Corinthians 11 as we're preparing to partake of the Lord's Supper together. And that passage emphasizes that Paul had been faithful in delivering to the church at Corinth what he had received from the Lord. And that formal way of saying it means that this is something that's to be the practice of the church. And he pointed out that the Lord, the night he was betrayed, took bread and he blessed it and he gave it to his disciples and he told them to eat of it. And he said that as you do this, remember that this is my body which is given for you. I want you to do it remembering me. And then the cup in like manner, and he blesses it, and he tells them that this is his blood, which is given for them, and he tells them to drink it, and to do so remembering him, and to keep on doing this until he comes, because that's the way we show forth the Lord's death till he comes. The Lord wanted us to remember not merely his pain, but him. He wants us to remember him. And I think he wants us to do that not simply for his sake. Remember that the one who offered himself up for us all is not wanting us to remember him just for himself. It's partly because of what he knows that remembering will do for us. There is an irreplaceable kind of renewal which occurs in the lives of the Lord's people as they remember what the Lord has done within history to redeem us. And Psalm 77 is as good an illustration of that kind of renewal that happens while we remember what the Lord has done as I can think of. Psalm 77 uses the whole vocabulary of remembering, or nearly so. I just point out to you in verse 3, I remember. In verse 3 also, I meditate. You look on down through it, I consider. In verse 5, I meditate. In verse 6, I remember also. And then I will remember twice more. In verse 11, I will ponder and meditate. In verse 12. So you can see that this is a psalm which is occupied with doing what the Lord asked us to do about his body and his blood. Although the object may be different in this particular case, the exercise is the same and the renewing that occurs will be the same. Psalm 77 is obviously, when you read it, from a time or about a situation where the singer is asking God to hide him away in the day of trouble. We're not told what the trouble is, but it becomes clear that he doesn't feel hidden away. He's asking for something that has not happened yet, and it puzzles him, and it confounds him, and it holds his eyes awake at night, and he's trying to figure out what to do about it. But as this psalm unfolds, there is a subtle movement from him remembering what he's been afraid of and what has been happening to him and what he's afraid will happen to him. To him remembering what God has done before, and him remembering what that means for him now, and what that will remember for him or mean for him in the future. That change from thinking about himself and his troubles to thinking about God and his wonders turns out to be the renewing power in his life. I think there'll be some of us here today who will want to think about that kind of renewing, given what we brought to this first day of the week and what we'll need to take from it going on into the week. So let's look through this psalm. I've tried to outline it in four movements. The first one, the first three verses, maybe first part of verse four, I remember God, all right. But when I remember God, I moan. My spirit faints. Verses 1 through 3. Here's the way it reads. I cry aloud to God. Aloud to God. The repetition suggests it's urgent. I raise my voice to God, and he will hear me. In the day of trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. When I remember God, I moan. When I meditate, my spirit faints. Selah. That word Selah, always, if I were really doing what it suggests, that we would all stop here and just be silent and think about what's just been said for a moment. Reflect on it. But you know I can't do that. So let's just ask you to consider what he says here. You notice so many times in the psalm, the psalms, the statements that are made about what will happen if we cry to God in the day of trouble are so encouraging. For example, Psalm 15:15, God says, call on me in the day of trouble and I'll deliver you. Or again, Psalm 20 and verse 1, encouragement from one brother to another. May the Lord answer you in the day of trouble. Or in Psalm 86 and verse 7, the person himself, in the day of my trouble I call upon you, for you answer me. That's what we expect. But in this case, I call on God in the day of my trouble. I cry out to him. I stretch out my hands for him. But my soul refuses to be comforted. That's not what we expect, is it? But it is what sometimes happens in real life, isn't it? And you know in your heart of hearts what that experience is like if you have thought very seriously about your faith in very many circumstances in your life. And what this psalm is about, what it starts with, is how it feels when that happens. When you seek God, you cry out to him, you stretch out your hand to him in the day of trouble, and the trouble stays, but the comfort doesn't come. This writer says, my seeking is not satisfied. My soul is not comfort. In fact, my soul refuses to be comforted. And my spirit is overwhelmed. The word moan here, or my spirit faints here at the end of verse 3, sometimes will be translated, my spirit's overwhelmed. Have there been any things that have happened in your life in the past week that have made you feel that way? In your work? In your family, in your relationships, and you're listening to the news, and you're thinking about our work, anything like that. I just want to remind you that every single week when we meet, there are people here in our assembly that know too well what it feels like to be in this situation. Some of them are here today. The psalm doesn't just stop. The difference between it and us is it doesn't just stop there. It goes ahead to show a healthy way of proceeding from that point onward. And the next step in it is, now I remember my song in the night. What's your favorite song? What's the one you remember? And I hope this week it'll be Hide Me Away, O Lord, sometime. I hope you'll find yourself humming that at some point to yourself this week, or singing it. I remember my song in the night. This guy might have been thinking about the song of Moses in Exodus 15, verses 1 through 3. I'll show you why in a second. But now he says, my spirit searches. My spirit was fainting, now my spirit searches. Verses 4 through 9, let's read it. You hold my eyelids open. God holds his eyelids open by not immediately answering when he called out or resolving his trouble. Now I'm so troubled that I can't speak. I can't pray. I can't cry out to God anymore. I consider the days of old, maybe the good old days in my own life, the years long ago. I said, let me remember my song in the night. Let me meditate in my heart. Then my spirit made a diligent search. My spirit inquired, in other words, asked or questioned. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be faithful? Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Are his promises at an end for all time? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his compassion? Then the notation, Selah. And then verse 10, then I said, I will appeal to the years of the right hand of the Most High. Now that requires a little bit of thought just to think about what's occurring here. In verses 4 and 5 and 6, the decision that he makes when he's so troubled he can no longer talk and when his eyelids are held open is to consider, to think over, not the present situation and its troubles, but what has happened long ago. You see what he is choosing to go back and to consider what has happened in history. One writer said, we all are creatures of history, whether we want to be or not, just as much as fish are creatures of water. We all live in not just in our own day-tight compartment, but within a world where things have been happening before. And what this fellow is doing is having to try to figure out what it means for God to be the ruler and for God to be the king in times when it doesn't look like it. He is. He's having to figure out what faith looks like when there are fears present that are unresolved. Or to put it in terms of our last 3 weeks together here, we read from Matthew 10 the statements, don't be afraid, don't be afraid. Then we read from Matthew 12 what the Lord did for his kingdom to overcome the other kingdom. And now we have to ask our question, what about our fears when it doesn't look like the Lord is being king? One writer that I noticed says, in every age, the people of God are called to proclaim and to embody the reign of God or the rule of God in the midst of circumstances that make it appear that God doesn't reign. When you look at the world, can you see how it could feel that way? And then he says, at the least, this psalm invites the honest expression of our doubts and fears. Indeed, in a broken and sinful world, there is a sense in which a mature faith cannot exist apart from doubt. I'm not trying to create any doubt in your mind. I am trying to say to you, it's all right. That's how faith is as it grows. Don't give up. Ask the questions that this psalmist goes ahead to ask. And as he considers the things that have gone on in God's history, he forms it in questions as his soul makes this diligent search. Now, please notice what it means for a soul to make a diligent search. Not to search for what's gone wrong, not to search for what people have done to let you down, not to search for what reinforces your doubts, but to search what's at stake. And what he does is to ask a series of six questions, and the language scholars will tell us that these are all questions that anticipate an answer of no. And just look at them here for a second. Will the Lord cast off forever? When you look at the history of Israel and the things that have happened and the way that God has time and time and time again come back to these people and tried to bring them back to Him, will the Lord cast off forever? Will He never again be favorable? Or are His mercies new every morning? Has His steadfast love forever ceased? That's His covenant love. Will God be unfaithful to His covenant? Is there a history of His having given up on the covenant? Once someone fell short of it or departed from it or didn't uphold it, did God give up? Is that the history you see in the life of Abraham or Isaac or Jacob or any of their descendants? Are His promises at an end for all time? Or do His promises go on? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has He in anger shut up His compassion? He may in His anger let people deal with the consequences of their poor choices. He's done that before. His wrath may go out, but it doesn't cancel out His compassion. Now, please look at that. If I had underlined it, you could see at least three of those statements involve the very characteristics of God which makes Him who He is, from Exodus 34. That third one on steadfast love, that's who God said He was. The next to the last one about being gracious, that's His essential character. The final one about His compassion, that's how God is. So what this is really asking, will God quit being God? When the troubles look to me like they haven't been resolved, does that mean that God is no longer God? Can I expect that He will just cease to be or go away? And the answers begin at that point. At verse 10 now, the next step begins. I appeal to the years of the right hand of the Most High. The right hand of God is His power by which He delivers His people. The things that He's done to use His power to rescue the objects of His love. I appeal to the years of the right hand of God. My spirit now is refreshed. And I've supplied that last statement. But that's the progression of thought. Verse 10 bears some thought. Then I said, I will appeal to you. You'll notice the translation differences that are possible with this verse. I notice, for example, that a couple of the versions, the New Revised Standard, New American Standard, suggest that the problem is that these troubles have now made this fellow think that God has changed. The New American Standard Version, for example, then I said, it is my grief that the right hand of the Most High has changed. Now, I grant that that might have been how the man is feeling, but I don't think that would explain the entire change of tone in the last half of this psalm. The other approach to it is the way the American Standard Version, King James, ESV, NIV take it, and it's the idea here, or at least the version of it. The American Standard Version, the old one, said, "And I said, this is my infirmity. This is how I'm feeling. This is my grief, my sickness. But I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High." It makes it a conscious decision, knowing that he's in danger of thinking that God is not being himself to him, to go back and remember how God's always been. And so this translation has it, "Then I said, I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High." At the moment when my doubts are creeping, when my soul is troubled, when I'm vulnerable, I'm going to appeal to how God has always been and what God has always done to help his people. That's wisdom. That's the right thing to do. That's what we have just done in this meeting this morning. We have remembered that God gave his only begotten Son so that we would not need to perish, but so that we could have life. So now then, things begin to change in this man's spirit. The key is this decisive, "I will remember," that you notice in verses 11 and 12. Look at them. "I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder on your work and meditate on your mighty deeds." That, I hope that's what we are doing this morning. And I hope that's what will happen as we go along this week. And as he does this, what he really turns back to is how God delivered Israel from slavery in Egypt, by bringing them out with a mighty hand and a great victory, and led them to the sea and then on to freedom. But look at the things he remembers now as he thinks about it. In verse 13 he says, "Your way, O God, is holy." What God is like you? Your way is different. Your way is in holiness. Your way is what people would see or hear in your sanctuary. You did it like nobody else would ever have thought to do it. And if you think about their deliverance from Egypt, you can say, who would ever have said, take a lamb a year old without blemish, offer him at sunset, put his blood on your doorpost, stay in your house, eat that lamb roasted with bitter herbs, with your shoes on your feet, and your staff in your hand, ready to go, unleavened bread. Who would ever have done it that way? God's way is holy. Verse 14, "You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples." Who would have turn water to blood, or turn dust into gnats and mites, or who would have brought frogs up on the land? Who would have made thick darkness that you could feel? God worked wonders, judgments on all the gods of the nations around. And then verse 15, "With your arm you redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph." It's an interesting way to describe the people. Jacob is a fellow who had his weaknesses. Joseph is someone who had been sold into slavery. With your arm you redeemed them. You rescued them. You, with your mighty power, simply brought them out and delivered them, made them into your holy people. What is happening in the remembering here is a reorientation of the heart and the mind to what God did before. And that's going to impact what God does now. And that's the last step in this process. I apply now God's past to my future. And now then, my spirit, which was troubled, is resolved to go live for the Lord and to face the day and to do what needs to be done and to know that things are going to be okay, that God is going to see to it. So what he notices, he describes here really in language drawn from Exodus 15 in verses 1 through 13, the song of Moses. He describes the way God delivered Israel at the Red Sea. Remember the Egyptians and their chariots pressing down on them, the people in panic, the water before them, no place to go, nothing to do, no hope apparent. It says, when the water saw you, O God, when the water saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled, the clouds poured out water, the skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Passage in Exodus 14 only mentions that God brought a great east wind and delivered the people by parting the water. But this shows the power of it. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters, yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hands of Moses and Aaron. There is the history of it. Look at the three qualities, the three things mentioned. Your way was through the sea. In the life of Jesus, God's way was through the wilderness. It was through the strong man's house. It was through the tomb. And God may have a way for his people, which can be through persecution or through challenges or through burdens. That may be how he does it. Not around it, but through it. And then your footprints were unseen. Who could have possibly have identified a trail for a whole nation of people to follow right out there through the sea? Underneath of the water, on the bottom, who could have seen the trail there? And then after it was all done, and after all of Israel had passed, what happened? The waters covered it all back up. And this man, who's in such trouble that he can't close his eyes, but he also can't see a way through it, reminds himself, God's footprints have been unobservable before. It doesn't mean they're not there. You shepherd your people. You took a group of frightened, helpless sheep and you led them through the great sea and then through the awful wilderness to a promised land. You did it with two workers, Moses and Aaron, who both had their weaknesses and neither of them saw the promised land. But you use them to shepherd your people. And this fellow comes away thinking, he can do that with me now. To all of us today, this should remind us of the fact that all of these things are true most of all in what God has done for us in Christ. Nobody would ever have seen a way to save people through what happened at that cross and from that tomb. Nobody saw God raise up Jesus. You and I don't now. God's footprints are unseen. Nobody saw how a few people from Galilee who were present with Jesus could turn into a kingdom that could spread all over the world. Nobody sees God shepherding his people right now, but we believe he does. And often our song in the night is, "The Lord is my shepherd." So folks, to remember like this is the key exercise of the Lord's Day. It reorients us, it renews us, it lets us be reminded of who we are and who God is. To remember like this is not only to bring God's past into our present, in some way it's always, some ways it's also to bring God's future into our present. We're able to hope because of memory. That's a strange paradox, isn't it? Today, I will remember. I hope you will too. I hope that's what we've done. In remembering, if you've been reminded that the Lord came seeking you, that he has a way for you, that he wants to shepherd you, and if you're willing for that to happen, why not make the good confession and be united with the work of Christ in baptism and be raised up to walk in his footsteps each day? If we can help you make that beginning, please let us know by coming while we stand and sing together.